We see here that God preserves his anointed, and use that word anointed, we are talking about the king. We're talking about David, and we know that Saul now has been rejected. We know that David has been physically anointed, but also he has received the Holy Spirit as well, and the Holy Spirit has departed from Saul because of Saul's disobedience, because he did not trust and obey. He went his own way, he did his own thing, and God had prepared David. And again, I think, and I've said this before, David would have been the first king of Israel had Israel not jumped and said, we want to be like everybody else. You know, we want to have a king just like everybody else. And so, you know, sometimes God gives us what we ask for, but we don't necessarily get what we really want. And this is what happened to Israel. This happens to Christians sometimes. God, I got to have this. I got to have this. I got to have this. And finally, God says, it's not my best for you, but all right, I'll let you have it. And he uses that thing to teach us how wise he is and how unwise we've been. And this is what's going on with Israel. And so Saul now has become exceedingly jealous of David. This has led to outbursts of anger against David with a spear, as well as more subtle attempts by Saul to murder him by placing him in military positions where he would be very easily killed. But of course, again, God's sovereign, God's in control. And at the end of chapter 18, we saw that David not only survived the difficult situations into which Saul placed him, but he excelled beyond all expectation, again, showing that he had the blessing of God and Saul did not. At the end of verse 27 in chapter 18, Saul has no choice but to allow and endorse a situation with which he absolutely dreaded, since David would be one step closer to his throne, marrying his daughter Michal. And as we move into chapter 19, we see that desperate Saul is no longer using subterfuge and deceit to get rid of David. Saul, in desperation, now reveals plainly that he wants David dead. And he makes that known to those around him, the leadership. And in verses 1 and 2, and again, we saw this last time, we're going to be looking at verses 11 through 17, but in verses 1 through 10, verses 1 and 2, as we just said, there's no more subterfuge. There's no more deceit that we see in verses 1 and 2. Saul, in desperation, lets his son and the people of his administration know that he wants David dead and he wants them to do it, and right away. So Saul, it says, and Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But it says that Jonathan delighted a lot in David, delighted much in David. Notice, but Jonathan's son delighted much in David. Jonathan, as David's covenanted friend, was indeed a true friend. And here Jonathan shows both loyalty to his friend as well as respect to his father and king. And apparently now it was evening and Saul gave the command to his men to kill David in the morning. And we see that at that point that Jonathan quickly rushed to David's side to let him know that he needed to watch his back and hide himself the next morning. In verse 3, Jonathan is going to be an advocate for David with his father Saul. He's going to meet with his father in the same field where David would be hiding, and Jonathan would then be able to quickly relate to David what he'd learned. Verses 4 and 5 of chapter 18. Excuse me again. Verses 4 and 5 again. Chapter 19, I'm sorry. Verses 4 and 5. It says, and Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he's not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you, for he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without cause? You have to admire the boldness of Jonathan. We mentioned this last time. And here Jonathan uses logic to persuade the king for a moment. And he argues that, Dad, David's only benefited you. He hasn't done anything harmful to you. David has only been a loyal subject to you. Jonathan then concludes by asking his dad this question. Why would you sin against innocent blood? Why would you kill him without cause? And so in verse 6, Saul takes an oath that he will soon break. Notice what it says in verse 6. Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Well, okay, wonderful. But the problem is Saul doesn't keep his promise. Saul didn't keep a lot of promises in this book, but that's a big one. Verse 7. Although dismissed from his position in the court, David returns to it now to serve, at least in part, as Saul's harpist, as he once did. And verse 8, then there was war again. It says David went out. So apparently David also continued, along with serving in Saul's court, playing the harp for Saul as needed, but he also continued his military duties and excelled in those. And in verses 9 and 10, notice this as we bring it brings us to our passage today. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul. He was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the harp with his hand. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped out of Saul's presence so that he struck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. So here we see a repeat of the past. David once again avoiding another attempt on his life from Saul with his spear. This time it sticks into the wall. He makes his way out. He's gone out into the night. Notice now in verses 11 through 17, and here it contains the account of Michal helping David to escape from Saul's men. And these verses are framed by a recurring statement. Notice the end of verse 10. And David fled and escaped into the night. Notice the beginning of verse 18. Now David fled and escaped. We've got two bookends here bringing these verses together. The inscription on Psalm 59 states that these verses are the setting of that psalm. Let's look at verses 11 through 17, and then I want to go to Psalm 59 for a second because it gives us some more details here. Notice, because it gives us David's attitude toward all of this. Notice chapter 19, beginning with verse 11, then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be put to death. So Michal let David down through a window. He went out and fled and escaped. Michal took the household idol and laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair at its head and covered it with clothes. When Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he's sick. Then Saul sent messengers to see David, saying, bring him up to me on his bed that I may put him to death. When the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was on the bed and the quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this? And let my enemy go so that he has escaped. And Michal said to Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I put you to death? Now, some interesting response here from Michal. But I want us to go right now to Psalm 59. Keep your finger here. We will be back. But notice, please, Psalm 59. This is the same time now. David pens this psalm. Psalm 59, please. And it's just 17 verses. Let's look at it. Deliver me from my enemies, O my God, And by the way, it says for the choir director, it says it was written when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. So this is what they did at night. He had people out spying on him ready in the morning to kill him. And of course, David slipped out. Michael allowed him to be able to slip out. But notice verse 1, deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Set me securely on high, away from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who do iniquity, and save me from men of bloodshed. For behold, they have set an ambush for my life. Fierce men launch an attack against me, not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord, for no guilt of mine. They run and set themselves against me. Arouse yourself to help me and see. You, O Lord, God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake to punish all the nations. Do not be gracious to any who are treacherous in iniquity, Selah. They return at evening. They howl like a dog and go around the city. Behold, they belch forth with their mouth. Swords are in their lips, for they say, who hears? But you, O Lord, laugh at them. You scoff at all the nations. Because of his strength, I will watch for you, for God is my stronghold. My God, in his loving kindness, will meet me. God will let me look triumphantly upon my foes. David trusted the promises of God. Again, unlike Saul, David faithfully trusted in his God. Verse 11, do not slay them, or my people will forget. Scatter them by your power and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. On account of their sin, of their mouth, and the words of their lips, let them even be caught in their pride, and on account of curses and lies which they utter. Destroy them in wrath. Destroy them, that they may be no more, that men may know that God rules in Jacob, to the ends of the earth, Selah. They return at evening. They howl like a dog and go around the city. They wander about for food and growl if they are not satisfied. But as for me, I shall sing of your strength. Yes, I shall joyfully sing of your loving kindness in the morning. For you have been my stronghold and a refuge in the day of my distress. O my strength, I will sing praises to you, for God is my stronghold, the God who shows me loving kindness. You see, it's interesting because the history behind this psalm colors the words. We understand more about, as we understand the background of the psalm, we understand what's being said. And so we just read the background of the psalm. The men are ready to kill David now in the morning. And in verses 11 and 12, back to 1 Samuel 19 again, in verses 11 and 12, first of all, we see the escape. Verse 11, then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him. Notice, in order to put him to death in the morning. Psalm 59, we just read verse 16, mentions this. So we see that Michael had somehow become aware, and we don't know how, but had somehow become aware of the plot of her dad, of her father. He was pretty open about this with his administration. So I have no doubt probably, she heard about it. They were talking about it. And maybe someone even clued her in, what's going on with David? Have you heard? And maybe they felt too that she's Saul's daughter. She's going to be against him too. I don't know. I don't know what they were thinking, but anyhow, it was communicated to her somehow that they were coming to get David in the morning in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you're going to be put to death. So now's the time, buddy. If you want to save your life, now's the time, because tomorrow morning it's going to be too late, because they're going to come and they're going to kill you. Verse 12. So Michal let David down through a window. So she's got men outside watching, but they're not necessarily watching for some stealthy, you know, way for David to leave the house because they don't necessarily believe that David knows this. They're just watching, basically watching and waiting until morning so that they can go into the house to kill David. So Michal let David down through a window and he went out and fled and escaped. Well, this kind of gives us an idea of what the circumstances were like here too. The first part of Michal's plan was to sneak David out a window in the dark of night away from the watchful eyes of Saul's men. And again, they weren't expecting this. They were expecting to, surprise David in the morning. So I don't think they would have been looking for something like this. And it's interesting, as I said, the circumstances are known about the house a little bit because their house must have been located along the wall of the city. Paul went through the same thing. Remember, they lowered him down in a basket? What we'll hear, we find that David was lowered down. Again, it must have been near a wall, the wall, and he was lowered down, the back of the house, down the wall so that he could escape. And then we find in verse 12, Michal would enact a plan of deceit now to stall for him in order to give David more time to get further away from Saul's men. Now, I think we have to be careful here. Some people say, well, in a circumstance like this, lying is okay. And I've heard this again and again. I've heard this from theologians. I've heard it from, honestly, people that should know better. Let me ask you a question. Do we have a God that is so weak that we have to help him out a little bit by lying? I mean, that in many ways, that's what we're saying. I got to help God out a little bit because the truth is not good enough for God. He's not really in control, so I've got to take over a little bit. Now, I don't think we have to be stupid, we have to be foolish and, broadcast news, but, is her lie the right thing to do? I think you can see Michael's lifestyle here. She obviously isn't an idol worshiper. By the way, this is Saul's daughter. We'll talk more about that in just a minute, but she's an individual, a woman of not very high character. She may be Saul's daughter, but, the nut doesn't fall far from the tree here. She's very much like her daddy in many ways. So there would be a plan of deceit here to get David further away. By the way, people say, well, her lying was okay. We can commend it in this case. Well, let me ask you a question. Should we commend her idolatry because she used a household idol to deceive? Should we say, yeah, idolatry is good too. If lying's okay, then idolatry must be okay too. No. Some say this about Rahab too. Well, Rahab lied about the spies, so it must be okay to lie in certain circumstances. My daughter had a Bible teacher in high school. And essentially he said this, and I challenged him on it, that it was okay to Rahab to lie about the spies being in her house because she saved their lives. So it was completely okay for that to happen. But is that what the Bible's trying to teach here? Is it endorsing lying? Is that what the Bible is saying here? I mean, she is commended for her faith in Hebrews chapter 11. Rahab the harlot is commended for her faith. And they say, well, because she is commended, it justifies her lie. God must be okay. Thumbs up to the lie here. Well, let me ask you a question. Does this also mean that prostitution is okay? Is God giving thumbs up to prostitution? Because that's what she was involved with. Is God endorsing her sin or endorsing her faith? See, there's the issue. God is endorsing her faith. not her methodology, not her lifestyle. God would never have done that. But in this particular instance, she showed faith. She showed what was right in this case. So all this simply means, folks, is that God is sovereign and can even use the sinfulness of man to accomplish his will. And he does many times in Scripture. And although Michael lied, it doesn't mean, oh, it's okay to lie once in a while if it's in our favor, whatever. That isn't what it means. What it means is that God is sovereign and he can even use the foolishness and the sinfulness of men to accomplish his purpose. We see that throughout the Old Testament. We see that throughout the New Testament. God used some very wicked nations to even discipline his own people. Does that mean God approved of those wicked nations? No. It just means God's sovereign. He's in control. And he used that in those particular cases. So again, Hebrews 11 commends Rahab's faith, not her sin. And what is done here is commendable in the sense that she's trying to protect her husband, but you can't say thumbs up to the lying. It must be okay to lie sometimes. Not at all. That is a wrong conclusion and an illogical conclusion in all of this. So first of all, we see in verses 11 and 12, the escape. But notice the deception now in verses 13 through 16. So notice in verse 13, Michael took the household idol and laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair at his head and covered it with clothes. Kind of reminds you of maybe some kind of a television program we might see. I remember through the years seeing a couple of them where they pretended that someone was in bed, and so they put, you know, maybe a kid escaped. And, you know, maybe it was a kid's program when I was a kid, and, you know, they put the pillows just right, and they put something at the head, and, you know, son did that in order to fool mom and dad because, you know, he was climbing out the window, and they would glance in, oh, he's still asleep, or oh, he's okay, and then they'd close the door, but he'd be out, you know, causing trouble or whatever he was doing. Well, it kind of reminds us a little bit of this, doesn't it? And so she puts him in bed, okay, makes this household idol, and the Hebrew here is teraphim. They were household idols that represented various deities. So this is paganism. This is wrong. Although this is an unusual size because they were normally 3 to 4 inches high, this one was large enough to mimic a normal-sized human body. So it must have been a very large one. So she puts this teraphim in bed, puts covers, you know, puts this over the head, make it look like David's hair or whatever. But it is a normal-sized human body, the way it looks as they glance in. So presumably, David did not know about this idol in the house. I don't think David would have approved. But again, it shows you the very low character of Michael here and the very low character of how she was raised by her dad. So this idol, this teraphim here, is apparently hers, not David's, or her and David's, okay? This is apparently hers, all right? This is Michael's idol. Constable writes this: the possessor of the household idols was sometimes the heir of the family in the ancient Near East. So perhaps Michael kept this idol for inheritance purposes as well as for worship. Perhaps teraphim had some connection with childbearing, fertility. Genesis 31:19, where barren Rachel kept teraphim. So it's interesting. So it may have something, you know, this is going to help my fertility if I keep this idol in my presence. So it may have had something to do with that as well. Now, I want to observe a couple of things here. Number one, Michael shows herself to be a woman who was not completely committed to Yahweh. No question. She has an idol, okay? Whatever way you look at it, okay? She shouldn't have had this household idol. And again, presumably this is not David's. David does not know about it. She was probably hiding it somewhere. I don't know. But not only did she have an idol, but once again, as I mentioned a moment ago, we see her lying and deceiving in the passage. So it just shows she's a woman of low character. We can commend her that she saved David, but again, God uses even the sinfulness and the foolishness of men to accomplish his purpose. So sometimes God does that. God decides to do that. Those who are truly committed to the Lord will not have idols. You know, this is true today. Little children, John wrote, keep yourselves from idols. And we find out in the New Testament that covetousness is tantamount to idolatry. It is a form of idolatry. How can covetousness be a form of idolatry? Because idolatry is anything that we put before God that becomes more important to us than God. That's an idol. And so covetousness is, I want what you have. In fact, I want what you have so badly. If I can't have it, I don't want you to have it. It is a jealousy. It is a covetousness of what you have. I want it. That's an idol. It's tantamount to idolatry. Covetousness is. So folks, we can become idol worshipers too. Because honestly, anything that we put before God becomes an idol. That can be family. That can be a house. It can be possessions. There's many things. It can be pleasure. Anything that I put before God is an idol. So let me ask you, do you have any idols in your life as a believer? Or are you committed to the Lord? You're truly committed to the Lord, you will not have those idols. Second thing about Michael here, this may be an indication that idolatry was tolerated or practiced in Saul's home. And would that really be surprising? No, I don't think so. Knowing what we do about Saul, not shocking. Also, she no doubt was taught about hypocrisy and deceit from a very early age. Look, we teach our kids from a very early age what life is all about. And hypocrisy, deceit, they learn things like that. I remember some years ago, I had a relative that told her daughter, tell him I'm not home. Tell him I'm not home. And so her daughter, who was pretty young at the time, got on the phone and said, well, Mom's not here right now. Let me ask you a question. What are you teaching your child when you encourage them to lie? You're not teaching them to tell the truth, that's for sure. You're not teaching them to be Christians of high character. You're teaching them to just, if it's convenient, more convenient, lie about it. If there's something you don't like and you want to get out of, lie about it. I can't tell you how many times through the years Christians have lied to their pastor. I've caught them. I've seen it. And it really is a shame. Or lied about their pastor. Sometimes that happens. But Jonathan, though, did turn out differently. So that shows us something, too. You may have a home that isn't great, but it doesn't mean that you have to turn out to be a jerk. You could turn out to be a godly individual as Jonathan was. So we see Michael, and we see Jonathan. What a contrast. We see Saul, dad. He was no prize. But yet Jonathan was. You are not destined to be like your parents. If your parents are ungodly, you're not destined to be like them. We have choices in life, don't we? The opposite is true. You can't go through life and depend on your parents' spirituality either. Well, they were good people, so, they were Christians. Yeah, but you can't depend on someone else's relationship with God for you. Because that relationship has to be true of you personally. And so we see now that she put a quilt of goat's hair at the head of this idol. Now, the meaning of the Hebrew is not completely clear. It's found in the Hebrew Bible only here and then in verse 16. Our translation as quilt is probably accurate. Okay, a quilt of goat's hair. Probably accurate. It was perhaps a quilt made from goat's hair, and it may have been used as a fly net while a person slept. That is possible. But it was hairy enough, and she arranged it in such a way that it looked like David's head. Now remember, this is the dark too. I don't know what David's head looked like exactly, but in the dark, it may have very well looked like David's head, all right? And notice, covered it with clothes. So she made it look like David was asleep in bed. So put clothing over it, that kind of thing, some of David's clothes. Made it look like David. And perfect, likeness, at least in the dark. Verse 14, when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he's sick. So here come the messengers, ready to take David, ready to kill him. Oh, you can't come in and talk to David. David's in bed. He's sick. So please notice that although we have to respect this woman's loyalty to her husband, at least at this point, okay, we're going to see she's not as godly and as loyal to David as she should have been here in a minute. She was, saving her own skin. And we also recognize God's sovereignty in keeping his anointed safe. We still can't endorse Michael's methodology. We can't endorse the lying. Neither does the text endorse it or approve of it. So Michael told the man, her husband was sick, don't disturb him, okay? He's very ill right now, you just let him sleep. The curious thing here is how well it worked. Okay, maybe the men were uncomfortable getting too rough with the king's daughter and the king's son-in-law, so they felt, we don't want to shake her down here. We don't want to just walk in and take her husband. You know, that could get us into trouble too, because Saul might say, "Oh, he's sick. Don't upset my daughter. How dare you?" And so they could have gotten in trouble with that. So in verse 16. Notice in verse 16 what it says. It says, when the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was on the bed with the quilt of goat's hair at its head. So here the soldiers find that Michael has played them like a fiddle. Okay? All of this has given David more than ample time to escape. And so they discover what's going on. They discover the ruse here. And then in verse 17, we have the excuse. So Saul said to Michael, why have you deceived me like this? And let my enemy go. Why was he his enemy? He'd done nothing wrong. Jonathan made that point. So that he has escaped. And Michael said to Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I put you to death? He was going to kill me, Dad. Liar. Once again, she's a liar. Once again, she shows herself that she is going to save her own skin. She's not as concerned about, she's somewhat concerned about her husband. That's commendable. But she wants to save her skin too. Jonathan, on the other hand, didn't care. Jonathan was going to do what was right regardless. He was going to stick up for his friend. But here we have Michael, what we hear so much today, Michael threw her husband under the bus. He was going to kill me. Was David going to kill Michael? No. She's lying. She's lying through her teeth. Remember what Billy Sunday said? Billy Sunday said, an excuse is the skin of a reason stuffed with a lie. That's what this was. She had a reason, but it was a lying reason. It wasn't true. The skin of a reason stuffed with a lie. She throws her husband under the bus. "Why have you deceived me like this?" her dad said. "You let my enemy go." So Saul expects more loyalty from his daughter than what he received. Notice how God in his sovereignty cared for his anointed. He took care of him. Notice once again that we are immortal until God calls us home. In the ancient world, a daughter's loyalty to her father normally would have been very strong, even after she was married. And God overcame what was the natural thing in order to take care of David. And at least she was willing to try to protect her husband. Again, did it the wrong way. In the end, threw her husband under the bus. But again, there is at least something to be commended here. And not much, but some, all right? Verse 17. So Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me like this? And let my enemy go so that he has escaped." And Michal said to Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I put you to death?'" Why should I put you to death? He's the enemy, he said, Saul said. Saul identifies him as the enemy. And from this point on, David never returns to Saul's court at Gibeah. David now is treated as an outlaw until Saul's death. "Let me go. Why should I put you to death?" This has the force of a threat here. In fact, the NET Bible says this: "Help me get away or else I will kill you." This is the force of what she said David was telling to her. "Look, you either let me get away, woman, or I will kill you." David never would have said that, and he didn't. She tells Saul that she had to let David go because he threatened her. What a terrible thing for her to do to her husband. And Michal lies again to spare herself from complications. Many times people lie to get themselves out of an uncomfortable situation, or maybe to keep themselves from what they consider negative or bad situations. They can't trust the Lord with telling the truth, so they feel like they have to create their own reality. They have to play God, and they have to lie. It's never right to lie. But like father, like daughter here, we've seen it in Saul's life, and now we see it in the life of Michal. Was she destined to be that way? No. But I have to say, Saul's still somewhat at fault here. Michael's at fault. It's her decision. She's an adult. Jonathan made a different decision, but her decision she made. She's got to live with it. It was wrong. Again, something commendable, but yet at the same time, it's still never right to lie. Notice the contrast, again, between two of the children of Saul. Jonathan had not lied to Saul to protect David. Michal did. Both Jonathan and Michael's words resulted in David's temporary safety. And God is able to protect when we tell the truth. That's obvious through Jonathan. God is able to protect when we tell the truth. I've told you before, Dr. Monfred Kober told me, he said that his parents in Germany in World War II protected Jewish people, because obviously the Germans were out, the Nazis were out to kill the Jewish race entirely, just wipe them out. And he said, "We never lied. My family never lied about who we had, what happened." Never lied. Now, I don't know what position God allowed them to be in with this, but he assured me we never lied about it. Look, God is able to protect us when we tell the truth. He is sovereign. He's in control. We just need to trust him and do what's right. Trust and obey. This is something that Michal was not willing to do, and her dad, Saul, was not willing to do. Jonathan and Michael's characters are quite different when we consider what they both said to their father. Let's be more like Jonathan, less like Michael. Let's be truthful with our speech, truthful with our actions. Let's not give excuses for disobedience, excuses for what we do that aren't true. Again, the skin of a reason stuffed with a lie. We don't need the lie to create our own reality. We just need to trust God with what He has brought and tell the truth, no matter what the cost. Allow the cost to be up to God. It's not up to us anyhow. You know, people can lie and they can still be in trouble through that too. Look, God is able to deliver. God is able to help us. We don't need to help Him out, okay? We just need to tell the truth. Colossians says, lie not one to another, seeing you put off the old man with his deeds. If we have put off the old man, that old self, that old tendency, if we have been saved, we know Jesus Christ is our Savior, then we need to live like it. And we need to live truthfully. Lie not one to another, seeing you put off the old man with his deeds.